You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an Altoona High School student who recently performed at a national poetry competition.
First, the state's legislature's budget committee met yesterday and made some key decisions. One of those was adopting a plan to allow sexual predators to be placed closer to schools and daycare centers than currently allowed, as long as they live in their home counties.
Patrick Marley joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, let's talk about this plan for sexual crime offenders and where they can live. First of all, why are lawmakers tackling this issue and wanting to change the way things currently work?
So what they're trying to deal with is this set of people in the Chapter 980 program. These are the worst sexual offenders who have been civilly committed. They're defined as predators, and it's very difficult to place them back when they are scheduled to be released, because there are so many local and state rules about how close they can be to schools, how close they can be to parks and daycare centers and things like that. And Representative Mark Bourne, who introduced this proposal, is particularly concerned that when judges are unable to find someplace for the offender in their home county, they start looking in other counties and placing them elsewhere. So he is shifting the responsibility for placing these people to local officials and putting a requirement in place that they have to come back to their home county. They cannot be shipped to another county. And to give the local officials more flexibility, they would the state law says you have to be 1,500 feet from a school or daycare center, church, playground. They would remove that. The local officials would determine the best placement, and then a judge would have to sign off on it.
Right, and I think people might hear that, removing that restriction from being near schools or daycares and things like that, and be a little worried, but that doesn't necessarily mean that these offenders are going to end up living next to schools and daycares.
Right. The supporters of this say, you know, local officials know their community is the best. They're not going to want to put anybody in harm's way, so they're not going to put a child in or put an offender next to a place where children gather. But they say they give an example of perhaps housing that's next to or near a police station that's maybe 1,200 feet from a school. They say a local community could determine that's a safe place to put somebody because, you know, the police are going to have extra eyes on them. They're right there. And so they say that they need more flexibility for these kinds of placements.
Have we seen lobbying or reaction from local governments who would be affected by this?
Not much. I mean, this came up with, little notice. It wasn't scheduled to be part of the agenda, and it got dropped into the Finance Committee, as things often happen with the Budget Committee. So we haven't seen a lot of reaction. Representative Bourne says that he did work with the Wisconsin Counties Association and other local officials to draft this. So they believe they've got the buy-in there from local officials. But we haven't heard from the community at large about this.
And this isn't a dollars and cents kind of item. Why is it in the budget?
Well, you know, there's always these arguments about putting policy in the budget and that it shouldn't happen. And I'd say both sides are hit or miss as to when they adhere to that point of view. If it's policy they like, they seem to be okay with putting it in the budget. If it's policy they dislike, then they make this argument that it shouldn't be in the budget. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is the nonpartisan office for the legislature, says this is not a budget item. It would not fit their definition of something that would belong in a budget. The supporters of it say, look, when these offenders are sometimes kept for months or years longer than they're supposed to be kept because they cannot find a placement for them. Obviously, that's very expensive housing for them, whether it's the Sand Ridge Treatment Center. And so they say there is a cost to this. One issue that swirls around this whole issue is concern from lawmakers that if they cannot find housing for people, that a court is going to come in and say that our system for dealing with these types of very serious offenders is unconstitutional and that people start getting released with no supervision whatsoever.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some of the latest action from the state's Legislative Budget Committee. And let's move on to another item there, reversing some cuts to elections-related jobs that Governor Walker had wanted in his budget proposal. What happened there?
So All the states got a lot of money. We got about $50 million in the early 2000s with the passage of the Help America Vote Act. This was in response to the Florida mess after the 2000 election. And the state here has been using that to support some of its election professionals. That money's running out. The state has to figure out how to fund them. There's about 22 positions that are paid with this federal money that we're losing. And Governor Walker wanted to fill 16 of those jobs with state taxpayer money, cutting six of them. The Finance Committee decided that we'd fund 21 of them. So the Elections Agency will lose one job, basically replacing state taxpayer money with federal taxpayer money.
And what kind of things do people do in these jobs? They help local governments, local clerks run the elections?
That's correct. They are the sort of state elections in Wisconsin are run at the local level, but we have the state agency, and it assists them. It runs a statewide voter registration database. It keeps clerks informed about frequently changing election laws, and you know, the last decade we've changed a lot of election laws, and it's the agency that determines who gets on the ballot and when. And you know, they did warn legislators who are obviously very interested in getting on ballots that that process would take longer if they cut all these jobs.
Another item that came up, the governor's plan for a facility for children experiencing mental health crisis. What do we know about that?
So the governor has really said that he's been trying to put an emphasis in this budget on mental health issues, and that goes across from these kinds of proposals to even into state corrections. So we're going to see a lot of stuff like this where he's trying to find money to address mental health concerns.
Big picture, where are we on the state budget now?
You know, we're really not moving terribly fast. This is typical in state budgets that the budget committee starts meeting and they kind of chip away at the easiest issues that we have and then work up to the really substantive things. We have, you know, transportation we know is a thing that is tying up Republicans who control the legislature. They can't come to an agreement there. There's some debate about some of the tax cuts the governor has proposed and whether to go along with them. All those things are being hashed out behind closed doors, and we're not seeing a lot of progress publicly on them. So in the meantime, they're working on these things like the Elections Board or Elections Commission, it's called here. It won't be probably for another couple of weeks that we see bigger issues being taken up, though the University of Wisconsin system is to be taken up next Tuesday. That's one key issue where, you know, the governor has recommended a 5% cut in tuition. Republican lawmakers have been skeptical of that. If they really do take it up Tuesday, we'll find out where they stand on that.
As we wrap up, Patrick, I want to step away from the budget for a moment. News broke this afternoon. Apparently, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark is getting appointed to an assistant secretary job in the Department of Homeland Security. There had been a buzz about him getting some kind of job. People talked about the top job at Homeland Security. FBI had things like that. What do we know about him leaving Milwaukee for the Capitol?
Well, yeah, this has been long rumored that he'd get some kind of job with the Trump administration. He's been a guy who has really stuck with Trump through thick and thin. Obviously, the president's been very controversial or been in the midst of a lot of controversy lately. Clark has been right there on his side. The one advantage for this job is that Clark would not need to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. You know, he's had some very serious things happen in the Milwaukee County Jail, including the death of a man who had his water turned off for days and died of dehydration. That would have been probably some very intense scrutiny from the U.S. Senate. He will avoid that by taking this other job.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joining us for an update on the latest action from the state legislature's budget committee.
You know how some people can go to a thrift store or a garage sale and find the most amazing things? With garage sale and flea market season upon us, Katie Bennett has a few tips for tackling the East Hill Neighborhood Thrift Sale in Eau Claire.
How to win the East Hill Neighborhood Thrift Sale. Number one, remember, all the good stuff is gone by 10 a.m. Number two, wear comfortable shoes, for you do not live in the East Hill, and you may spend many hot hours searching for your car, just like Sir Henry Morton Stanley searching the Congo for Dr. Livingston, except you are carrying someone else's crockpot. Number three, do not bring your toddler. Toddlers have sticky fingers. Number four, Do not go only to the kid sales. Visit the sale of the old man with rusty things, for he is selling a Cookie Monster jar identical to the one of your childhood that your mother gave to your brother, who lives closer, even though you were the one who made cookies. Haggle the old man down from $3. You want your childhood back, damn it, but you don't want to overpay. Number 5. Bump into a friend and marvel at how big her new baby is, because he is huge, and also because her first child refused to eat, which caused no end of grief. Rejoice in the largeness of her second baby. Heft him. Ask what on earth she's been feeding him. And be happy for her, and also for yourself, because you do not have to carry him around on your hip. Recommend your chiropractor. Number 6. Stop at the houses for sale. They don't want to relocate their grandmother's china to yet another house, for they know that this time they will not unbox it, but rather store it awkwardly for decades until after their own deaths, by which time the children will no longer remember their great-grandmother. So when they uncover the box of spidery china, they won't remember when, as infants, they chewed on the fancy spoons, nor when they were 5 and felt so proud finally sitting at the adult table until they spilled the cranberry sauce. The children will simply begrudge having to clean out the basement. To avoid future resentment, the china is sold now for far cheaper than it's worth. Number 7. Overhear another man selling his house saying he is getting rid of everything. Browse through an unused page-a-day calendar of daily affirmations, a middle-aged woman's wardrobe, shoes, handbags, and costume jewelry, books on cognitive behavioral therapy, grief, and loss. Do not ask the man why he is moving. The answer is filled with enough sadness to drown you. Buy the cognitive behavior book because when you wake in the night, everything is dark and scary and so loud with worry. Number 8. Ponder the house selling only one of the Harry Potter books, which is odd because it was the best of the 7, and if you're going to get rid of any of them, why Goblet of Fire? Number 9. Realize that if he sees it, your husband will want to know why you bought a book on cognitive behavioral therapy and ask about your night thoughts, which aren't really a big deal, but they belong to you and the dark. Leave the book in a little free library. Number 10. Check back to the car carrying a cribbage board, crockpot, Cookie Monster, 2 flower pots, a beaded bracelet, and Goblet of Fire. Collapse into the hot seat and wonder where you are going to put all of this stuff.
Katie Bennett is a writer in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
The East Hill Neighborhood Thrift Sale in Eau Claire is this Saturday, May 20th.
Now 53 students recently competed in the Poetry Out Loud competition in Washington, D.C. Students are judged on their ability to recite poetry with not only precision, but with heart and individuality.
Janessa Gould joins us now to talk about performing. She's a senior at Altoona High School, and she's the Wisconsin Poetry Out Loud champion and performed at the National Poetry Out Loud competition a few weeks ago. She joined us from our studio in Eau Claire. Janessa, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get into poetry performance?
When I was a sophomore in high school, our English teacher required us to memorize a poem from the Poetry Out Loud archives, and then we had to recite it in front of our whole class. We had a classroom competition, and then I went to regionals at UW-Eau Claire, and I've kind of stuck with it since. I love Poetry Out Loud.
And this isn't just a simple matter of memorizing poetry and then repeating it. This is performance. It's kind of like acting.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you memorize your first poem and then you make it to regionals and you memorize a second poem. And if you make it through regionals, you have to then memorize a third poem. So there's a lot of work that goes into it.
What goes into a really good performance of a poem? Because, I could read a poem out loud and I think people would be bored when I did it. What makes a performance, stop nodding, what makes a performance compelling?
Definitely a deep understanding of the poem. I think when I was a sophomore, I just kind of recited the poems. I read them. But as the years went on, I learned, oh, I have to understand what this means before I can make somebody else understand what this means. And I had to remember that this is somebody else's first time hearing the poem, so I really had to convey that meaning to the listener.
How can you tell if you're really getting it? You're connecting with your listener, and in your own mind, you're clicking, you're understanding, and you're being really present in what you're saying.
I kind of just have to have that aha moment for myself first, and I would read a poem once and be like, okay, I kind of understand this, and say it's my 20th time reciting the poem in my head, and I'd be like, oh, so this is what this really means. So it kind of just took a lot of repetition on my own end in order to convey that meaning for the listener.
Talking to Janessa Gold, she's the Wisconsin Poetry Out Loud champion. She performed at the National Poetry Out Loud competition a few weeks ago. Janessa, I understand you've got a poem to read for us. First of all, tell us about the poem and at which stage in the competition you performed it.
I do. The poem is The Art Room by Sharon McCallum. It was my first poem that I performed at Nationals. I would say it's one of my favorites out of the three that I picked. I really was able to connect with this poem, and I found some deeper meaning when I looked into the author's background, and I was able to understand it a little bit more.
Yeah, go ahead and give us a reading.
Okay. The Art Room by Sharon McCallum. For my sisters. Because we did not have threads of turquoise, silver, and gold, we could not sew a sun nor sky, and our hands became balls of fire, and our arms spread open like wings. Because we had no chalk or pastels, no toad forest or morning grass slats of paper, we had no color for creatures. So we squatted and sprang, squatted and sprang. Four young girls, plates heavy on our backs. Our feet were beating drums, drawing rhythms from the floor. Our mouths became woodwinds. Our tongues touched teeth and were reeds.
Oh, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
That was really something. How did you come up with your own style? Because I've heard many poets read over the years, and each poet has their own cadence and their own unique style. How did you come up with the way you read poetry?
So the first time I read a poem, I try to get an idea of my head of what I would like it to sound like. And then as I practice, I try not to change that idea, because too many things shift in my head and I overanalyze it, like, oh, what could I make better? But I found out that usually the first time I say something in my head is the best, so I try to stick with that.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about how this competition works. You and 52 other high school students from around the country, what's it like to be there and be judged on your performance?
It was definitely one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had, to be with those 52 other students and to share that common love of poetry and appreciation for the arts. Is it's definitely not something I get exactly like where I go to school, but to be with those other kids was just amazing. And yes, it's a competition, but there was no like fierce competition against each other. We knew we were all there to support poetry and the arts, and it was an awesome experience.
Do you find that some poems are easier to read than others? I mean, I can imagine if I were reading something like, I think that I shall never see a thing as lovely as a tree. You know, that seems a little easier to me than what you just read, which has so much nuance in it and it doesn't have all kinds of rhymes. Are there kids who go for maybe the more simple poems?
Yeah, I think it definitely depends on your personality. At Nationals, you would meet somebody and you could kind of get an idea of their personality, and then you would see them perform a poem and you're like, oh, see, that kind of fits with their funny personality or their more serious personality. So I think people usually pick poems that are relatable for them. I mean, that's at least what I try to do and kind of what I see in others.
Does doing this poetry performance inform the rest of your life? Does this help you as a student or in your daily life?
I think so. I've gained a lot of confidence through doing Poetry Out Loud. I feel like now I have the ability to get up in front of any group of people, whether I know them or not, and kind of speak about anything. I just have that confidence behind me, and Poetry Out Loud has really helped me with that.
Now, I know that one of the areas that you're judged on is the quality of the diction, the way that you pronounce the words. Do you have any advice for the rest of us about how to maybe not rise to the level of a great poetry reading, but how to sound a little more clear and with that kind of elegant diction that you just had?
You know, I'm still trying to figure that out for myself a little bit. I performed in front of a classroom full of my friends, and after I performed, they came up to me and they were like, "You sounded completely different from how I've ever heard you speak before." And I don't know, I think there's just something about performing something that you're passionate about and you've really found the deeper meaning. It just kind of changes the tone of your voice and your diction.
This is your senior year. Are you going to keep doing poetry performance when you're out of high school?
I think so. I think I'll try to find some poetry readings. I'm really interested in Button Poetry, which they have every first Monday of the month in Minneapolis. So I think maybe one day I'll get the courage to perform at one of those.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Janessa Gould, a senior at Altoona High School and recently represented Wisconsin at the National Poetry Out Loud competition, and she was with us there to talk about her award-winning performance.
Now, a letter to the UW-Madison campus community from the outgoing chair of the student council made the rounds on social media earlier this month. In the letter, Carmen Gossi said she is leaving because, quote, this institution does not care about people of color.
On the American University campus earlier this month, a half dozen bananas with their skins inscribed with toxic messages were found hanging from black nooses. At that time, the university had elected its first African-American female student government president.
We're taking a step back now and looking broadly at racism on college campuses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced racism at college or university? What was your experience? Have you intervened in racist behaviors on a campus? How? And what questions do you have? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Chad Dion Lassiter joins us now. He's the president of Black Men at Penn School of Social Work, Incorporated, and a professor of race relations at the Westchester University. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And we've also have Deshaun McKinney with us here in the studio. He just graduated from UW-Madison last week. Congrats, Deshaun, on graduating.
Thank you very much.
Big news there. And he's also a people scholar and is part of UW's First Wave program. Deshaun, welcome back.
Nice to see you again.
And Deshaun, let's start with you. How big a problem do you think racism is on college campuses today? How large does it loom for students of color?
I think it looms about as large as it does in the nation. I don't think it's, you know, like college campuses are like these weird bubble spaces, very contained, but they're microcosms of what's happening on the larger scale. So I think they manifest itself. I mean, these are the same people coming from those places where the things you see on the news are happening often, and that's why they're manifesting. So I think it's about the same proportions you'd find, and even in a lot of ways more so, though, because the proportions of people of color who exist on these spaces are much lower than actually exist in society. So then it's a lot more concentrated, and so like the effects can be more damning, I guess you could say.
Well, you've been on campus at least 4 years. You just graduated. Did you notice any change in that climate during the 4 years that you were here?
I think the biggest change that I recognize is that per the work of students of color, primarily, is that there's a lot more open communication between students and administrators, right? I think when I first came on the campus, it didn't really exist, and we weren't really in those spaces and allowed in those spaces and had those lines of communication. But I think that over the years, that's really opened up because students have kind of pressured the university and kind of forced their way in.
And Chad, I want to get you in on this. What are your thoughts on how big the problem of racism on college campuses is?
I think the problem of racism on college campuses is similar to the problem of racism in the democracy. When we're talking about institutional racism, which is prejudice plus power, when we're talking about white privilege, when we're talking about white supremacy, as well as microaggressions, implicit biases, the same thing that we see in the society is the same thing that we see on college campuses. Nevertheless, college campuses do at times provide the potential of safe places and safe spaces to have the dialogue, to have the conversation, to have multicultural centers, to have Africana studies for those PWIs, predominantly white institutions, that do have them. But this is something that we've seen at Cal Berkeley with bake sales. This is something that we typically see around Halloween on college campuses as it pertains to, you know, blackface, white bodies wanting to pretend to be black, but they don't want the burden of being black in a democracy that's rife with white supremacy.
Now, Chad, you mentioned some terms there, bias you mentioned, and microaggressions, for instance. Can you walk us through some of the different ways that racism might manifest itself on a college campus?
Yes. Well, when we're talking about microaggressions, it could be coming into a classroom and everyone looks at you as if they're surprised that a person of color is in the classroom. It could be a professor who, when we're talking about urban context or issues that are centered along the color line, but specifically to African-Americans, the conversation may not open to the full scope of the class, but to a particular student. It could be comments like, you know, I don't see you as black, or I'm colorblind. Or you're not like the rest of them, Deshaun. You're very articulate. And then when we're talking about implicit biases, these are the neurotransmitters. This is the neuroscience. This is the way the brain functions. We all come to a context with implicit biases. But when we're talking about implicit biases as it relates to people of color, it's those deeply rooted stereotypes that gives birth to the birth of a nation that D.W. Griffith had in his silent film, where we're talking about black people as being three-fifths, black people being subhuman. And sometimes those implicit biases lead us to what we saw in Ferguson, what we saw in Baltimore, what we see in traffic stops vis-a-vis police and people of color.
And Deshaun, I want to get you in on this line of conversation, too. Talking about microaggressions, you're familiar, I remember, with the hashtag RealUW here at the UW-Madison campus, where students using a hashtag reported some of these incidences of the types, say, that Chad was just talking about there, and drawing attention to the experiences that they were going through. What would you say that experience, that opening up about some of these racist incidents, racial bias, microaggressions, what was it like to bring that out into the open?
I think it's exhausting to bring it out into the open, right? I think the impetus behind it is to pressure and challenge administration to do more and to improve the actual climate. But it's a lot of work to bring that. And it's not only like the physical labor of making sure it gets out, but the emotional and the mental labor of having to relive those experiences. And also put them out there for audiences who you never know how they're going to receive it, and right, who receive it in all different types of ways, and people can dismiss it, or people can say that you're whiny or whatever, what have you, all the things that are, you know, being propagated in the on various media sources. So I think it's very exhausting. I think at the same time, it helps to further solidify the community amongst those students who do go through those things, so they know that they're not the only one who's experienced something like this, and that they can turn to other folks and find that community, and it helps them connect to each other, you know, and it helps make a campus of 43,000 students shrink down in size some.
And is that something that you've experienced yourself, or your friends have gone through during these 4 years here?
Absolutely. I think I've experienced some microaggressions. I've never in my time here that I can recall experienced any blatant racism. And I think it's funny because I also think that's part of people's implicit biases, why I've never have. Right. I'm a black man, the most feared thing in America. And I walk around and more often than not, if it wasn't like 80 degrees outside, I'd be wearing a hoodie and high tops and walking around the campus like that. Right. And I know that's a threatening image for people. Right. So people haven't directly confronted me on campus for the most part. But I have a lot of friends who've been through things, you know, people who've had their faces spit on, who've had bottles thrown at them, who've gotten into fights, who get all types of racist comments, both in the classroom and outside of it. And even things like the current controversy in Madison with all the bars and like the racist dress codes, right? And the fact that they don't play hip hop music because they don't want to attract the wrong crowd. That wrong crowd is me. It looks like me, you know, it walks like me. It has my culture.
What are the dress codes?
It's things like don't wear baggy pants, you know, like no like do-rags or what have you, those kind of things. Like things that are mostly attributed to black culture, right? In hip-hop culture in a larger sense, which is also rooted in black culture and, you know, in black history. So these are things And it's a numerous bars, and they keep coming out, and it's a huge issue because, again, they don't want to attract the wrong crowd. So even that, you know, it spills out into how do you enjoy your college experience beyond the classroom? It makes it a lot harder, right? And the other people, again, they dismiss these things, or they can just go about their day and not have to acknowledge it or not have to engage with it because that's not their culture. It's not the music they like. It's not the way they dress. And maybe they don't have friends who are affected by it either, so they just go out and have a good time, and it never registers as some deeper issue.
We're talking right now with Deshaun McKinney from UW-Madison and also Professor Chad-Dion Lassiter from Westchester University talking about racism on college campuses. And we were talking earlier about Gozi's letter that she wrote, Carmen Gozi, when she said, quote, she was operating in a white position as a person of color. Deshaun, do you have any thoughts about her experience and what she said, what she might mean by that?
Well, I thought the letter was fantastic. It was because it's something that you don't expect to come from somebody in a position like that. You know, and I've gotten to know Carmen well over the past year. And I think she has one of the strongest kind of radars of what justice means of anybody I've ever met. So I was happy to see her speak her truth about something like this. And I think when she talks about working in a white position as somebody of color, she's talking about how these institutions, these structures were never meant for people like us. And until you make some kind of drastic change, if you keep doing things the way that you're doing them, even if they're working effectively, that means that there's still this huge sector of the population that's blocked out because it wasn't built for us. So she's working in this position and within these structures and answering to these people or working with these people and have to build relationships with these people who are existing in this structure that's really not built for her as somebody who's pushing it. And she talked about how she's the face of a campus who doesn't look like her and all these people, you know, and there was a lot of backlash about the things that ASM undertook this year coming from the majority population on campus. And there's people who want to run now against that. And, you know, and people even funded by or supported by these alt-right groups that exist nationally just to make sure that people like Carmen don't get in again and do the things that they were doing.
I want to come back to that. But, Chad, I want to get you in on this conversation, too. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience as a professor in a predominantly white institution?
Oh, yeah, certainly. So I started off for a period of time where I was at the University of Pennsylvania, specifically the School of Social Policy and Practice. What's unique about the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice is that we make it mandatory for our MSW students, our doctorate-level students, be it the DSW or the PhD in social welfare, to take a full-year course on American racism and social work practice. And so over those 7 years that I was at the University of Penn, I've been able to train social work students to become social change agents on every side of the color line and on every side of the gender line. Because to dismantle this thing called American racism, or what David T. Wellman calls the portraits of white racism, you need all humanity to do it. One of my students was former Vice President Joe Biden's daughter, Ashley Biden. My experiences, though, remind me of the questioning of black humanity. We look at that with the former president, Barack Obama. We question his intelligence. We question his intellectual property. We say that he went to two universities because of affirmative action, but we never talk about Ira Katz Nelson's work when affirmative action was white. So it's me standing in front of the class with about 40 or 50 white students, both at University of Penn and Westchester, talking about several things about our democracy, talking about how Thomas Jefferson did not have a love affair with Sally Hemings, but it was statutory rape, and students are dismayed. Or you quote qualitative or quantitative data, and students are dismayed. And then when you say to them, well, you have your Mac, you know, do a Google search. They do a Google search, but there's no acknowledgement. And the same questioning doesn't happen on the other side of the color line with white professors who, for the most part, in my experiences at several universities, are mediocre at best. They come to the context with a peculiar arrogance. They don't read the materials, but they want the students to read the materials and know the materials. So it's the questioning of black intelligence, black humanity. We saw it. It's the same thing that W.E.B. Du Bois talked about in The Souls of Black Folk. It's the same thing that James Baldwin talked about. We question black intelligence, but we never do that on the other side of the color line. So my experiences have been the glare and the stare. Students who have found me to be imposing because I'm 6'6", I'm dark-skinned, I'm bald-headed, even when I'm wearing a three-piece suit. Students who, when they get out of class, will walk down the walk and see me after class and not really recognize me, render me invisible. But I love those opportunities because they're teachable moments to have a conversation with students of color as well as white students and others, to really talk about the racial elephants that oftentimes are in the room and go unacknowledged. And so I've had some interesting experiences, but I don't get stuck on stuck, you know. And what I mean by that is I'm always pushing the paradigm. I'm always trying to train the next cohort of students who are going to speak truth to power on all sides of the color line.
And we're talking right now to Professor Chad Dion Lassiter from Westchester University. And also with us in the studio is Deshaun McKinney from UW-Madison, talking now together about racism on college campuses.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about racism at college, on campuses? Have you experienced this yourself? How did you react? What do you think needs to change to address things like the microaggressions our guests have been talking about, implicit bias? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up the conversation in just a bit, maybe take your calls in just a bit, here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now about racism on college campuses with Chad Dion Lassiter from Westchester University and Deshaun McKinney, who just graduated from UW-Madison.
We're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this firsthand, racism on a college campus? What happened? What do you think could address racism on campus, whether it's extra education, cultural centers? What should administrations do? What can students do? And what questions do you have for our guests? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Deshaun, I want to ask you, there was another bit from that letter from Gozi that we talked about earlier, and she wrote that, quote, "This institution perpetuates and suppresses the voices that are the most vulnerable." And Deshaun, what could the university do differently to help make these vulnerable people be heard?
I think that's a good question. Well, I think some of the stuff that they've started to do already, right? We just reopened. I think this is the third time now on Madison's campus that we've had a Black Cultural Center. So that's a space where students can go and feel welcome. They have the R Wisconsin program, which is directly dealing with all these issues, things like white privilege and intersectionality and identity. For next year, all incoming freshmen, I think, would have to go through that program. So there's some work that's being done. I think some things that could be done a lot better is, you know, more support for the different programs that bring these students to the university, right? A lot of people in the First Wave program wouldn't have come to Madison if it wasn't for First Wave. There's no other draw for them, right? And a lot of students of color leave this university not feeling like a badger, but they're feeling like, I love the People program, or I love the First Wave program, or Posse, or so on and so forth. But those programs aren't really very strongly supported by the university. And I've seen this because I've been essentially on staff for some of these programs and seen all the politics of the university and how they're pressed down. I think that's something they can do. I think that they can push harder to increase the numbers of students of color at the university, right? Out of 43,000 students, Black students are 2% or less of that, right? So there's not many people that look like me at this university, and the university isn't making a strong push to bring more of those students in. You know, it's a lot, increasingly so lately, it's been a lot more focused on money and bringing those student populations who have a lot of money, who contribute. So, like, the business of education is overriding the actual climate and the care for students in a lot of ways. So I think those are some things that they can do. And, you know, the ultimate goal is to get to a point where none of this stuff has to be done, where we don't need a Black cultural center, or we don't need special houses or programs specifically designated to target these students. That's the ultimate goal. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
And Chad, I'm curious about your take on what Deshaun just said. I also want to follow up on something you said about in a predominantly white institution getting training and social work. And I know that American University, for instance, is opening an anti-racism center, and it's going to be run by an African-American historian. Do you think there are some filling in of the gaps to be done in terms maybe especially of history and awareness and social context?
Yeah, definitely. I think for me, it's also on a macro level. It's also looking at it from an institutional standpoint, making sure that our faculty and our staff, our teachers, our faculty and staff are people of color as well. We also need to look at gender equality. We just don't want our classrooms to represent it. We also want our faculty and our staff to represent people of color. We also want to make sure that there's no discrimination that's taking place as it relates to our admission officers, right? We need to have some oversight. We want our board of trustees to that are PWIs to be representative of the larger society as well. I think when we're talking about anti-racism centers and anti-racism trainings, I think those things are necessary. I think courses are necessary. But ultimately, we have to have a conversation around the dynamic of white supremacy, white privilege, and institutional racism. And we also need to be mindful that it's not just people of color who see white supremacy, institutional racism, white privilege, microaggressions, and implicit biases as the challenges on PWIs. You also have white professors. You also have Asian American Pacific Island professors. You have one of the foremost leading theorists around race relations in the country, and Tim Wise. You also have a Peggy McIntosh. You have Joe Fagan. You have Doug Massey with his book, American Apartheid. And so I think it's both and. I think we definitely need to have these required courses. But I differ from Deshaun in one sense. I agree with him from the perspective of the goal is to not have these places, ultimately, because we're saying that we're fostering not tolerance but peace. I don't see a world where we will ever have no racism. I think like Derek Bell and his book, Faces in the Bottom of the Well, racism is permanent. I think every day, though, I'm encouraged, my students are encouraged, my mentees are encouraged, that we get up attempting to dismantle this disease, this sickness that is sickening the democracy, and not just along the lines of Donald Trump. And so I don't ever foresee a time at the University of Penn, for instance, where you won't have a W.E.B. Du Bois cultural house, or at Westchester University where you will not have Frederick Douglass Institute. I think those things will always exist, just like we still need halal houses at the University of Penn because anti-Semitism is not going away. And so I think what we do is we continue to have these conversations, but we look at it also from a covert perspective. So as Deshaun says, it may not be something that's happened to him, but when you say we don't want anybody coming in who's wearing hoodies, well, we never really look at the fact that a lot of white students come to class with a Starbucks cup and they wear hoodies as well. So that's that implicit bias. We cross the street when we see Hispanic males of color or males of color who are wearing hoodies, but Columbine teaches us something entirely different. And so it's the way we view black people in demarcated spaces with the racial contract that's enforced by, you know, this upholding of white superiority and white supremacy. And so we see it on our campuses. Beverly Tatum's book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together at the Cafeteria Table? The cafeteria table serves as a metaphor to say, I'm with someone who understands my experiences.
And Chad, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me. And Deshaun, you hang in there, man. Once again, congratulations. And feel free to reach out to me via email. You can Google me. I would love to continue this conversation with you at some point.
Appreciate that. One love, brother.
Fantastic. And Deshaun, thank you so much for coming in again to talk today.
Yeah, no problem.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, president of Black Men at Penn School of Social Work Incorporated, professor of race at Westchester University. And also with us, Deshaun McKinney, just graduated from UW-Madison last week, recipient of the People's Scholarship and a member of the First Wave program. They joined us to talk about racism on college campuses, and you can keep that conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.